Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 9, interview with Zach Steer from the Sheep Mountain Lodge. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that makes you zealous, zeroes you in, and zips you on the sport of dog sledding.
Three Z's for Zach. That
you
was nice.
You got it. But wow. You know what zip means, Tim?
No, what does zip mean to you?
Zip actually means to proceed with energy.
Nice. Well, that's maybe where they come up with zipper. That's
no. Okay. I'm not sure.
Anyways. Hi, everybody. We have got a wonderful interview today with Zach Steer from Alaska. He owns the Sheep Mountain Lodge. It is a pretty neat interview. We talk about not only about Zach, but also about the Sheep Mountain 150 and also the lodge and how he's taking care of the lodge with he and his family.
Yeah. It also brought us back memories. Tim and I actually used to own a resort up here in Cadillac, Michigan. Years back, we owned it for 4 years. It was a very busy time in our life. Kind of brought back some memories, didn't it, Tim?
It did. And she's giggling here because I don't like to call it a motel. It was actually a motel, but we call it a resort because it sounded better. But it was a pretty neat little time. I grew up here in northern Michigan at that little resort, little motel. And as we got older, we sold it. We got it back on a land contract. And my wife and I decided to step out of the corporate world and move up. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And I think we saw a lot of similarities in the interview about people that were wanting to try to find a little bit different lifestyle and a lifestyle that helped promote family values and wholesome hard work. And I think he's found that. So it's kind of an interesting interview.
Yep. But he gets to dog sled while doing it. We didn't get to dog sled.
No, I tell you.
We just got to wash a lot of sheets and
listen to a lot of snowmobilers driving around our house. But other than that, it was pretty neat. But we want to do a couple of shout outs. Just to say thank you so much for the wonderful comments and the wonderful feedback that we're getting from folks.
First one is to David Eggert from the Cleveland area. He is with the Greater Cleveland Siberian Husky Club. He races racing Siberians, of course. He's also the newsletter to Glista and was so awesome to put www.sleddogpodcast.com on his newsletter. So we're real thankful for that. And thanks so much, David.
Thank you so much, David.
And also we wanted to do a thanks to Leslie Gillis.
Yes, Leslie is a friend of Zach's and an acquaintance of a lot of different folks up in the Alaska area. And Leslie, thank you so much. She's been providing not only the names and some ideas behind who to interview, but is also actually helping us coordinate it. So, Leslie, you're the official Sled Dog Podcast correspondent in the Alaskan area. So thank you so much for that.
And also just another thanks to Greg Sullenton. He was episode 8, but he also put us on his website. So
yep, it's on Mushing Magazine's website, so you can listen to it off his site, or you can click through it, I guess, to his site, back to our site, or just go off to Sled Dog Podcast and listen to episode 8 about Greg Sullenton from Mushing Magazine.
Right, and if you don't have a subscription to Mushing Magazine, go out there and get one.
Boy, I tell you, you've got to. Matter of fact, if you know anybody that is into dog sledding, or maybe not into dog sledding, that's just getting into it, maybe they've come with you to a race or come visiting, it would be a great present to drop off but to actually subscribe or get a subscription for somebody. Because the magazine is just a neat magazine, and Greg is really opening it up to a number of different articles to kind of broaden the audience a little bit, and I think it's just a great move on his side.
So, but before we get on to Zach and learning all about Sheep Mountain Lodge and the Sheep Mountain 150, I want to remind you that after Zach's interview, of course, will be our Vet Tips with Dr. Tim, and today he's going to talk about vaccinations.
Yeah, he's really going to stick it to us.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's bad.
That is bad.
Yeah, sorry.
All right. Anyways. So hang in there. Just a reminder again, you're shopping at Amazon during Christmas time. Please use the Sled Dog Podcast to get to Amazon. That would be awesome for us.
Doesn't cost you any more money, but it gives us just a little bit of percentage that Amazon does a kickback. So it helps us pay for our bandwidth and support the site so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Right. So if you like the show, go ahead and you don't have to buy anything particular. Just if you're doing some shopping, going through, and I think they've got free shipping right now. Or was
yes.
That over? I don't know.
20, yes, always have.
Always free shipping. Okay, wonderful stuff. So, hey, let's get on to the interview with Zach and then Dr. Tim right after that.
Great.
Hey, well, thank you, Zach, for meeting with us today. We're pretty excited not only to have you doing the interview, but more importantly, to also hear a little bit about Sheep Mountain and what that's all about. I guess, Zach, to start us off, you've been mushing for about 10 years now?
Yeah, 10 years. I started off in 96, the winter there, helping a friend of mine in Anchorage, Robert Bunsen, who's a many-time Iditarod finisher. I was started off like many dog mushers as a handler and just sort of got addicted to the sport and been doing it ever since.
So how did you get into it? Just needing a job, the handling, or was it a passion to try to get involved?
It was more just he was a friend of the family, and I volunteered that winter. I just, about 3 days a week, I'd go with him on his training runs, do kennel chores, and it was just sort of my indoctrination into the sport. He was running dogs out of Anchorage, Alaska, and he was training up for the 97 Iditarod. And prior to that winter, I'd never been on a dog sled before, and I don't know what really got me into it or why I wanted to do it at the time. It just seemed like a neat thing to do, and as the winter went on, I just became more and more interested in it. He ran the Iditarod that year and told me he was going to take the next year off and said, well, hey, if you want to run my dogs, you're welcome to it. And so I put my name on the Iditarod list, got qualified, and 1 year from my first dog sled ride, I was towing the line at the Iditarod myself.
That is amazing because, we come from the sprint world, so I just can't imagine making that 0 to 90 mile an hour leap, from running up the other sprints and mid-distance and so on and jumping right into the Iditarod. Do you think that's helped you?
Well, it was kind of the ignorance of youth, I think. I didn't know what I was doing, so as long as you really don't know what you're getting into, it can't be that bad, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But you did, you ended up finishing well, and didn't you get Rookie of the Year, or am I off on that?
I was close. There was three rookies. We were all competing together. Mark May, Christopher Knott, and myself, and we raced each other to the finish, and we ended up finishing three in a row, but the other two guys were right ahead of me. So, no, I wasn't Rookie of the Year, but I was 22nd, and I was pretty proud of that for a first-time Iditarod run.
Now, how quickly, then, did you go ahead and start building your own team?
Actually, the following year, Robert ran the dogs. These were still his dogs that I was running. And so I helped him train, and, we sort of alternated years. He ran in 97, I took the team in 98, he ran in 99, and then in 2000 I ran the dogs again. But then that our alternate team strategy sort of came to a stop because after 2000, my wife and I purchased the She Mountain Lodge, and that became our full-time passion and occupation, so I had to put the dogs on hold for a while.
As you got into Sheep Mountain, I guess, tell us what's that all about or why, what drove you to come out there? You're pretty far away from Anchorage.
Yeah, well, it's about a two-hour drive from Anchorage. I suppose it was another one of those things where youthful ignorance is bliss. We were, my wife and I were sort of young semi-professionals, and we were looking to get out of town and do something exciting and new. And at the time, running a lodge seemed like a very exciting thing to do. And so we made the leap, and we had a house, and we had just been married, and so we moved up here together to run a business together so we could work together and live together. And, I suppose in the back of my mind, it seemed like a very ideal place to run and train dogs, but that wasn't really the focus of why we came up here. Eventually it turned out to be a great move for dog mushing because the area and terrain around here is just perfectly suited for training the dogs, and within the last few years, we've actually started our own race here, the Sheep Mountain 150. I'm sure we'll talk about that later. So, yeah, we came up here, and the Sheep Mountain Lodge has been our main endeavor for the last 8 years. We celebrated our eighth summer up here this year.
That is fantastic. Now, looking at your website, you have a bunch of cabins, 11 cabins, and is there a restaurant there also?
Yeah, basically the Sheep Mountain Lodge is a full-service restaurant. And our summer's our main season. We cater mostly to tourists, and actually we have a pretty strong Alaskan clientele. We really feature a lot of fresh foods, and we're not really a greasy spoon diner. We do a lot of, wild Alaskan salmon and, fresh dinners and things like that, homemade soups, fresh baked breads and pastries. So, a lot of the Alaskans that are driving back and forth always stop here, so we're a favorite stopping place for them. But we've got a full sit-down restaurant. We've got a bar. Then we have 11 guest cabins that we rent out, all with private bath and shower. They're very nice, clean, and comfortable cabins. This will be my little pitch for the lodge here so all your listeners can come and stay at Sheep Mountain next summer.
Absolutely.
We're ready.
Yeah. You're ready to come up too, yeah?
Oh, I tell you, our hearts are just jumping for joy if we could make it up there. Now, did you build all the cabins, or were they there?
Well, there were 10 cabins when we first got here, and over the years we've done improvements to different facilities. You know, this is the lodge was originally built when the Alaska Highway was punched through. It was 1946, and so as any Alaskan or maybe even upper Michigan place, if it's been there long enough, it becomes a building with a series of additions. And so we've added our own additions onto the buildings as we went along. Last summer, we undertook a major project. We built 4 new cabins. We took 3 of the oldest ones out and put 4 brand new log cabins in. They're very nice with full kitchens. And so that's been a real popular addition, especially in the winter season, because now we can cater to Alaskans and to a lot of dog mushers that are coming and using the lodge as a base camp for their training operations. And they can bring their own food and just basically have a rental cabin for a week or two or whatever they want to do while they train their dog teams.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely
so
wonderful.
Generally you service summer, but you're trying to expand into winter. Before, did you have any winter clientele?
Well, it's kind of funny. Summer's our main season, and as hard as we try to sell the winter operation, it's hard to get people, tourists, to come to Alaska in the wintertime. You know, we've got great attractions. You got the Northern Lights, you got cross-country skiing, snow machining, dog mushing, but it's cold, and it's dark, and we'll always have those obstacles. So for the most part, we cater to Alaskans, and we've actually sort of curtailed our winter operation. We used to do full-service restaurant, and now we actually keep the restaurant closed. We don't do food service in the winter, only in the summer. But with those new cabins, they've got these kitchens, so people can bring their own food and take care of themselves. We've still got the hot tub and the sauna, and that's always popular in the wintertime. But by far and large, summer's our main operation, and we get people from all over the world. It's really fun. It's a great business. We meet new people, great people every day, and I think probably one of the biggest benefits of working in the tourism industry in Alaska is every day people come and remind me of what a great place we live in, and it's easy to take for granted when you live here, but every day, you know, I see the jaws drop, and people just say this is one of the most beautiful places they've seen in their lives, and a lot of these are, you know, they're world travelers. They've been to lots of different places that I've never been to. So, I take that to heart.
Oh, absolutely.
So then, at what point did you have to make room at Sheep Mountain for a kennel?
Well, after a couple of summers, we decided that we would have the time to put in the dog kennel. I can't remember exactly which summer it was. I think it was 03 or 04. We cleared out a little bit of extra land, actually up right up by the highway. It was something that we knew we'd never put any cabins on or anything, and put in room for about 25 dogs, you know, a relatively small kennel size for trying to be a competitive distance musher. But we didn't want to overwhelm ourselves. We knew we had no aspirations of becoming professional dog mushers. We just wanted to have a dog team up here so we could run and train the dogs in the winter months, mostly for recreation, and, you know, do a little dog, you know, racing on the side, just because with the Iditarod experience, that seemed a logical thing to do. So we put the kennel in, and then we rapidly expanded our breeding program with my partner, Robert Bunsen, the dog musher who I originally started training and racing dogs with in Anchorage. Bred up some extra litters, and before you know how dogs can multiply. We had 25 dogs in no time.
Wow, that's great.
Awesome. Then you took those dogs and you started just branching out into the Yukon Quest and...
Yeah, we, kept dog mushing. Robert would, you know, even in the first years that we had the Sheep Mountain Lodge, he would come up here for training runs. And of course, I'd always run the second team just because I was jonesing to get on the back of a sled. And a couple of the races, I'd run his second team, or sometimes he'd give me the A team, and, you know, in some of the mid-distance races up here, just for fun.
Okay.
And he continued doing the Iditarod every year, and so I would always be his, you know, his handler at the start, and we went up to Nome a couple times just to watch him finish. I became more of a dog mushing spectator. We live about 60 miles from Glen Allen, and so every year I'd drive up and I'd get to watch the Copper Basin 300. I actually learned a lot in those years where I wasn't competitively racing.
Okay.
You know, more I became a kind of a dog mushing analyst, and I learned by observation. And so I would go to the Copper Basin 300, and I'd go to the Wolverine checkpoint, and I'd watch these, you know, mushers, Martin Boozer and John Little and all these top Copper Basin competitors, D.D. Jonro, and see what they were doing, and, you know, sort of put that in the bank, in the back of my head of, you know, how to do well in dog mushing. And later on, once we got the kennel established here, I sort of used those lessons, you know, turned that into a positive dog mushing experience as we began to do more competitive racing ourselves.
Zach, and, you know, a lot of the different mushers have had, you know, college educations and so forth. Did you find that your college led you to any of this? I noticed you went to, is it the University of Colorado?
I went to, I graduated from Colorado College, which is in Colorado Springs. Went there for 4 years, got a degree in political economy, and that was the closest thing to dog mushing that they had.
Yeah.
Basically, it was I put off real life for 4 years, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know if the college degree helped me as much. I was an athlete when I was in college and in high school, and I swam for 4 years competitively in college. And I think that background actually has lent itself more, you know, as a competitive athlete myself, you know, in my previous life, I like to say. I'm not so much the athlete anymore. I'm more the coach. But that knowledge, that athletic training, I took, you know, classes in exercise physiology. I've studied it. I've run a marathon. I've done a half Ironman triathlon. I used to do all these sprint triathlons. I've got a good athletic background, and I think it's, you know, the training philosophy for people is pretty, you know, endurance training philosophy is pretty similar for canine athletes. And I've tried to tailor my training philosophy for the dogs to what I used to do and what I've learned and what I read about. And I think that's been a successful part of our program. And I see that more and more with other mushers, too. I mean, you listen to Jeff King, and he talks about how he reads the latest Lance Armstrong book, and he's using those philosophies of Lance's training, you know, and applying that to his dog team training philosophy and obviously getting success from that.
Absolutely. And, of course, the economics maybe with the restaurant and the resort side, right? We'll throw that in there a little bit for the college-bound folks.
Yeah. But that's right. I'm not saying drop school.
Just make sure you swim or do some kind of, you know, workouts there so you can understand how to race the team.
We've had the same experience, so.
Yeah, exactly. So looking at the transition from the fact that you've got the lodge now, you're starting to run, when did you decide to put in the Sheep Mountain 150?
See, this will be the fourth year that we've run the Sheep Mountain 150, so that would have been 2004, I guess, would be the first winter.
Yeah.
And it was something that, you know, after a couple of winters up here at Sheep Mountain Lodge, you got familiar with the trail system, and I just realized that it was just a great area for dog mushing and training. There's all these old mining roads and trails and some mountainous terrain. It's very different than a lot of the dog sled races that I've been to. I think back when I was a rookie trying to qualify for the Iditarod for my two qualification races. I ran the Kinnick 200 and the Klondike 300, and the majority of those races are run on rivers. The Cusco 300 are run on rivers. And so when I came up to Sheep Mountain, here I am running dogs up and down the sides of mountains and around these bends and canyons. And it was just beautiful country. And I thought, you know, I really need to share this with other dog mushers. And so we scouted out a great trail, figured out a format for a race that would be dog musher friendly, a time of the season that would be convenient for the other teams, and it just really all sort of fell together. I got a great community up here. I got some really dedicated individuals who, as trail breakers, support from other lodges. I mean, it just all sort of fell together. The first year we started off with 30 teams, and to my surprise, you know, we had a full field signed up within a couple of weeks before the race even started. The second year I bumped the limit up to 40 teams, and the race sold out in about 2 days. And
wow.
Last year we bumped it up to 50 teams, and this year we're running 50 teams just because that's as many as we can fit dog trucks in our parking lot.
Nice.
Okay. I was going to say, how do you determine how many teams? How did you figure that out?
Yeah, well, for one thing, I don't want to get too big because we sort of run it under the general philosophy here, whereas I'm the general, and it's a one-man committee, and which means I do a lot of work, and I don't want to make it too much work. I want to keep it fun.
That matters.
And when you get too big, then you have to have a committee, and you have to get too many people involved, and I want to keep it simple. That's sort of my philosophy, keep it simple, stupid. And then the fact, you know, we can't fit, you know, there's a carrying capacity for the trail and, you know, logistical concerns that any race has. 50 seems like a good number. I'm sure I don't think we'd go any higher than that, even if we could.
So tell us a little bit about the race. Why is it so popular? What are the mushers like about it? And how many dogs are you running on the race and so on?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. It seems to be a popular question. Everyone says, why is it so popular? And I think that the sport is just becoming more and more popular in general. I think there's just a demand for races like this. Maybe not necessarily Iditarod length races, although the Iditarod's got 80 or 90 teams signed up each year for the last few years. I just think there's more and more people that have their own, you know, 10, 20 dogs, or maybe they combine dogs with another musher, and they say, hey, I'm going to go out, you know, and do something besides our regular training runs or adventure training trips. You know, we're going to try something different. And so these mid-distance races seem to be having a resurgence lately. And it's not because of the, I don't think it's because of the prize money or the, you know, the, you'd like to say fame and fortune that you get from doing well in the races, but we all know that that's not exactly true. I think it's just because it's fun and people are doing it more. And so this race just really fit into that that demand there.
Now, we're assuming you don't get to run the race, right?
Yeah, that's the downside, is that as the race director, I don't get to run the race. My wife's run the dogs every year, or most of the years, when she wasn't pregnant, to various degrees of success. I like to kid her about how I teach her all the shortcuts, but she never seems to take them.
That's probably okay. A good thing.
Yeah. She's
a good, honest person, we see. That's good.
Yeah. And last year I tried to teach the lead dogs the shortcut, but they didn't take them.
they weren't the first dog team out, probably, right? That was the problem.
That's right.
Well, that's great. And so everybody seems to like the race. Is it, it sounds just absolutely beautiful, especially because of the mountains and so forth.
And what date is that exactly?
This year it's going to be on the 15th and 16th of December. And, you know, we've got it set up so it's basically a 24-hour race. You know, the teams, you know, they don't have to make a long trip out of it. If you're a working musher, like most people are, if you can go to, you know, you can work on the Friday and the Monday, and you can do this race over the weekend and, you know, not be too beat up, I suppose.
Not too beat up, yeah.
can't hanging imagine. Over cliffs, yeah. Going around, yeah. Missing the crevasses, sure.
I think, you know, a lot of the mushers just say that they really enjoy the trail. It's just beautiful trail. It's a lot different than a lot of them see, and there's a lot of variety here. You know, we start off, you do some mountain running. You're doing a lot of alpine running where you're up above tree line. And then there's about a 10-mile stretch, and it's just ethereal. It's in the middle run. It's right in the middle of the night. It's usually 3 a.m., I think 4 years in a row, it's been a clear sky with northern lights, and you're just going through, it's sort of like walking through a woods on a snowy day, the old the poem, and it's just, it's got a great feeling to it, and I enjoy it. I mean, these are the trails that I use in my training, and to me, it's the greatest compliment when these other mushers say that they wish they were able to train here all winter long, too.
Oh, absolutely. Now, is it mostly federal land, or is it state-owned land?
Most of it is state land up here. There's a little bit of federal land, but in my neck of the woods, it's mostly public land that we train on. So, you know, fortunately for us, access is an issue that we don't have too many issues with right here. It's pretty simple to get the permitting process complete for doing the training runs and the race.
Oh, that's incredible. And I think for us, it's wonderful to hear just the different adventures other than the Iditarod and just our little 5 and 7 mile races that we do. So that's neat. Tell us a little bit about last year in the Iditarod.
Yeah. How did we get that third out of there?
Yeah, well, I'm still trying to figure that out myself.
Right place, right time.
We actually, were tracking you. We do a curriculum. We homeschool our children, and they have to pick... We have three children, but two other children did this with us. So there were five girls, and they all had to pick two mushers to track. And one of them picked you. And I honestly really had not paid attention to you previously. And I thought, Zach Steer, who's this? And she was all over the place when you came in third. It was a really cool thing. So we were actually getting to know you way back in March.
Yeah. Well, I always seem to be the best musher that you never heard of. That's why I always introduce myself to other people that don't know the sport of dog mushing too well.
Well, that's all changed now, you know, now that you've got the third place. Tell us a little bit about it.
I don't know. In the Iditarod, it's first or nothing. You can get second or third place, and they still don't know you.
Yeah, I guess that's true. The people in the know, but nobody else outside, which is probably what, you know, the other 300 million people in the United States. But
that's right.
So tell us about that. You did a lot of different strategies, and we heard your interviews at the very end when Scott Sloan and some others had interviewed you. Tell us about that. Tell us what was different that year versus your previous ones.
I can briefly summarize the four Iditarods that I've done. You know, the first one in 98, I was a rookie. It was all new, but I had a well-trained dog team, and we did well. You know, we finished 22nd place, which I think for any rookie is an accomplishment. The second time I did it, 2 years later in 2000, I was a little more competitive. We improved on our place. We finished 14th, and I just sort of got a little taste of racing, and I think that memory is probably what inspired me to do better. 2005, I signed up again for the Iditarod. That year, I had a lot of difficulties. I had some busted sleds, busted body, busted dogs, and ended up scratching. And it was a decision that I do not regret. But we were actually, competitively speaking, doing quite well at the time. I'm sure we were in the top 10. Who knows where we would have finished, but you know, that's beside the point. So last year when I did the race, I actually didn't think we were going to do so well. I had had a really busy summer, you know, before running the lodge full time, and then we went into a cabin construction project through the fall, and I really didn't get to sit down and focus on the dog training really until, you know, the first or second week in December, not even until this point last year. But once we did start our training, we had an ideal training season. I had an experienced dog handler, which can make a world of difference, so I wasn't doing a training curve with somebody new on the second sled. I had a pretty good group of dogs, although it was a pretty young group of dogs. But what kind of the wild card, which I thought was going to hurt me, was the fact that my partner, Robert Bunsen, was also going to race last year. So here we were, the two of us, and we have a pool of about 38, maybe 40 dogs, if you count some of the limpers and three-legged ones, between the two of us, and we're trying to field two Iditarod teams, 32 dogs out of this small kennel. And so we did all our training together, and we do our dog trading, and we decided that I would run an A team and he would run a B team. And we, a couple weeks before Iditarod, we sat down and we penciled it out, and we didn't have enough dogs. Fortunately, I made some calls, and we were able to lease six dogs between the two of us, five of which actually ended up in my racing team from John Little. These were some young, inexperienced dogs, but they were really well-trained athletes, and they sort of formed a good core kind of to give us the depth that we needed to field the two teams. Once the race started, I'm sure you're aware of all the difficult trail conditions that we had last year, and all the mushers encountered that. But I don't know if it was good luck or just good preparation, but I just seemed to avoid a lot of the pitfalls that captured and caused, you know, difficulty for some of the other mushers. I can't tell you how many times I almost crashed my sled. I can't tell you how many times I almost hurt myself in the first 3 days of the race, especially when we were going through the Dalzell Gorge, going through the steps area, and then going up and over Rainy Pass in the windstorm that we had last year. That really, we made some right decisions. We came to the intersection at Rainy Pass last year, where a lot of the dog teams took a wrong turn and followed the Iron Dog Trail. I know exactly where it happened. I got there, and I almost made the wrong turn too, except for the fact that Allie Zirkel was coming back from making the wrong turn, and if it wasn't for her coming back, I would have followed her tracks down there. And so she saved me a couple of hours, and we both took the right turn. Other teams behind us missed it, and it cost them a few hours extra time. Little things like that over the course of the race, just everything seemed to fall in my favor. We made right decisions, and we got lucky, in addition to having a well-prepared, well-trained dog team. I mean, you can't have success without that base, too. So,
Zach, what are some of the obstacles you guys faced? What were, you know, was obviously we heard everybody telling us it was such a rough course and a lot of those strange things that happened, but what were some of the things you faced?
Well, specifically, it was low snow conditions. We just, you know, snow became a luxury on a lot of the parts of the Iditarod Trail last year, and this is to be expected. You're not making any excuses. You take what you get, and I always say that, you know, I don't care how bad the trail is, as long as it's the same bad trail for everybody else. You know, we went through going up into the Alaska Range. Areas that are normally 10, 15 feet of snow had 2 or 3 feet of snow, which was insufficient to cover the stumps and the the tundra and the tussocks and things like that that you normally glide over. Well, this year you were running into that kind of stuff. Going up and over Rainy Pass, there was some very serious headwinds. It was hurricane force winds going through there, and it caught a lot of mushers off guard because it's an area that typically is not windy like that. At least that's what I've been told. I got some serious frostbite on my face just because I wasn't prepared for it going through. My partner, Robert Bunsen, he got stuck up on the pass for almost 12 hours there. His dog, his leaders balked right before the summit, and he ended up camping out there in this nasty windstorm, which, you know, turned some teams around. You know, he stayed there for 12 hours.
Was he okay?
He was fine, but he almost scratched. And this is a guy who's finished 10 Iditarods and one of the toughest dog mushers I know, smart guy, and he was just mentally fried, as was his dog team. So it was really an accomplishment for him to finish. And I mean, being stuck up there through the night in a raging blizzard. I mean, usually you hear about these things happening up on the coast and you prepare and expect them up there, but to have it hit the team so early in the race, I think that took a lot out of a lot of teams last year.
So where it might have hurt some teams, it also probably helped some teams like yourself and others that maybe just pushed through or didn't hit a stump, I guess.
That's right. You know, it just... One inch can make a big difference when you're driving your dog sled. If you make it around the tree, or if you get wrapped up on the tree, and Doug Swingley, me and him probably passed the same tree. I just sneak by, and he slams into it and cracks a rib. Didi Jonro does the same thing too, and so all of a sudden you have these top flight quality dog mushers that are no longer in competition. So little things like that. So I don't want to rack it all up to fate and destiny. I mean, The better teams did prevail. I mean, you take a look at the top 10 finishers, and they're all quality dog teams. But there was adversity all along the trail last year. It was really challenging, kind of fun in some ways. I mean, I always say the harder the trail, the better, especially for the younger mushers. And maybe that's a reason why some of the top five teams were of a little younger generation this year. There was a lot of beating on the body. And I saw some tired old dog mushers at the finish this year, that's for sure.
That's true. You know, and one of the things that I guess, we go back and forth in our minds watching you guys, because we watch it from 3,000, 6,000 miles away sometimes, is trying to stick to your plan. And, as you prepare the race, you say to yourself probably, okay, this is what we're going to do. And how much does that change when all of a sudden you heard, Didi's out or Swenson's out, somebody's out? How does that affect you? And do you change and modify, or do you stick to your original plan?
Well, I can tell you what I do. I mean, I stick to my plan, and I only make changes based upon, weather, trail, and my own dog team. I try not to make any changes based upon the actions or inaction of other dog mushers. Not at least, at least until the last 2 days. Maybe on the last day or two of a race, if it can make a difference between a position or two, you might make adjustments accordingly. And I did this year. But the ability to adapt as the race goes on, especially when weather comes in, really played a key. Because I think a lot of teams got hurt this year because, the weather was really bad, and it would have been better to stop and camp. And yet some guys said, well, I just rested for 4 hours, and I have to go now because that's what my plan says. And maybe the better thing would have been just to rest another 4 hours until light out or until the wind subsided or something like that. Some people can get stuck, too stuck on their plan, and not be able to change. And then the opposite being, some guys will see another musher and say, oh, that guy's leaving the checkpoint early. I better take off early. And so you really don't want to be playing off of other dog teams, at least in the first two-thirds of the race. Just running your own plan, sticking to it, but being able to adapt as necessary, mostly for what's best for your dog team. And I think that's one of my strong points. I'm able to make decisions. I've got a game plan going in. I pretty much map out my first couple of days of the race, but I'm not afraid to make changes as the race progresses.
As you got to the end and you hit the coast, when did you find out that you were in the third or in the top five, that kind of stuff? I guess, what are you thinking at that point when you're coming in a couple hundred miles away from finishing?
Well, I mean, right about the halfway point, I realized I'm in the top 10, and I'm happy, and I'm like, as long as I'm already telling myself, don't screw us up, don't do something dumb. And so, if anything, I became a little conservative, and I didn't make any long runs. It was probably a good thing because I was able to preserve my dog team's speed. I think if any a keen observer of the race would look and see that I had And I'm proud to say I had some of the fastest run times between checkpoints in the second half of the race, you know, all the way up the coast, even to into the finish. We were catching, you know, relative to the teams around us, we were probably the fastest team from the coast on. Now, there was a big enough gap, I wasn't able to catch everybody, but, you know, I was in, I think, on the Yukon River, I was probably in 7th or 8th place, and by the time we got to Unalakleet, I was in 5th place, and by the time we got to Koyak, I was in 4th, and then, you know, right outside of safety on the way into Nome, I was able to pass Martin Boozer and pull into 3rd, and it was because of the good decisions that I had made earlier in the race, which allowed me to maintain that team speed. That, I think, was an important part of our race strategy.
Now, in the Iditarod for you, does having been born in Alaska mean anything?
Different than it would be if, you know, if I was born in Michigan, per se.
I think it makes the Iditarod more normal. I don't know the perspective of people that come from the lower 48, but I would imagine it might be more intimidating if you hadn't grown up as a kid going downtown and watching the start of the race and seeing the Ferrandi sprint races every year. You know, those were normal activities. We used to strap on the skis and go out and cheer on the Ferrandi racers in the wintertime. That was just something me and the family did. You know, we weren't into dog mushing, but it was just something you did growing up in Anchorage. And so there's a little less intimidation, I suppose. I'm used to being outside. I'm not, you know, I did the Boy Scout thing growing up, and I can take care of myself in the cold and the dark. And so for a lot of people, that might be intimidating. I think once they get up here, and it's just a comfort zone. You learn to expand your comfort zone. But I could see that as an additional challenge. And then especially for people coming from abroad, I'm always amazed at the challenges that international mushers have to overcome just to get to the starting line of the Iditarod. I have a lot of respect, you know, for Team Norway when they come over, and they have to go through all the quarantine and the transportations and the logistics and getting their drop sacks ready 2 weeks before the race. I mean, that's really an amazing feat. So I my hat's off to those guys, too, you know, for taking on that challenge. It's just even that much more impressive.
Absolutely. I mean, that amazes us when you think that they have to charter, you know, cargo planes to get over here and do different things. That does blow me away. Now, you know, I didn't ask you this earlier that I should have. How did you get to be, like, what, 24, 25 years old and never be on a dog sled living in Alaska?
That's a good question. I mean, there's not even an old picture of me standing on a dog sled. When I grew up, I was always on the swimming team or the cross-country skiing team. I think the closest I came to dog mushing was taking our golden retriever ski-during, you know, on the trails after school. But no, never dog mushing, not until after college when I came back and started handling for Robert Bunsen.
Oh, that's neat.
And have you ski-jured at all since?
Very little, because as you know, when you start dog mushing, you have little time for anything else.
Right, yeah,
absolutely.
Right.
So tell us about the future a little bit. What's going on for this year, and what do you got planned for not only the Iditarod this year, but other races?
This year's plan, I take it 1 year at a time. I'm not a professional dog musher, and so I was thinking of not racing at all this year, but that became more and more difficult not to do, especially after placing so well last year and having such a young dog team that I thought had a good potential to repeat their performance or maybe even improve on it. So we signed up for Iditarod, and I plan to race the Iditarod again this year, and as well as Robert too. So we'll be trying to field two teams out of a 40 dog kennel. We just signed up my wife to do the Tustamina 200. I think we'll go down and do that Kenai Peninsula race. We haven't done that one in a few years, and that's always a fun race to be a part of. We'll be putting on the Sheep Mountain Lodge 150. That's here in about another month, and we've got a full team of 50 teams signed up. We had 50 teams signed up by noon the first day. Lots going on here, and then we'll just be training dogs and running the lodge through the winter season. That's our plan for the winter.
We do have one question that we want to ask you, which as we watched the video of you coming in last year, you said something that just kind of we didn't understand. So you got to tell
probably
us.
Probably a dumb lower 48 question. So what are the clean shirts and the dirty shirts?
You know, I said that kind of off the cuff, and because a good friend of mine who helps me trail break for the Sheep Mountain 150, Stan Smith, he's an Iditarod veteran. You know, right before the race, he comes up to me and he says, go out and beat those clean coat mushers, you know. And up here, that means the guys with the new jacket every winter and all the sponsor patches on their coats, you know. Because Stan takes one look at me and he sees that the only patches on my jacket are the ones covering up the holes. and so last winter when, you know, you got guys like Lance and Paul Gebhardt and myself taking first, second, and third, you know, we're all three relatively low budget, small kennel, you know, do-it-ourselves kind of mushers. We're the dirty jackets. We're the guys that don't have the new coat every winter. And so I was just sort of an exclamation point on the three of our success last winter.
Oh, we loved it. I mean, it gives you that little bit of the feeling of the underdog, but yet at the same point that, you know what, this is a sport for everybody. And you don't have to have, you know, $800,000 a year in endorsements to run it and run it effectively. So yeah. I guess it was exciting for everybody, you know. So we took it as a not a negative, but as a positive, and just a, it just shows you that it's all about the dogs and about the chances of hitting a tree or not hitting a tree, and everything kind of all matters. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, as we finish up, is there anything that you'd like to tell the listeners about your family or about the Sheep Mountain Lodge or anything
Any
else?
Any passions that you have in the sport or?
I don't know. It seems like we covered a pretty good range in our discussion here. I hope if any of your listeners are up in Alaska, you know, in December, you know, please do come and watch the Sheep Mountain Race. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but as a spectator event, it's really first class because unlike the Iditarod or a lot of other races, the checkpoint is road accessible. You can meet the mushers. It's a low pressure atmosphere, so you can really get a feel for a race and as a spectator. You know, I just hope, you know, to see all the other mushers and have a good time this winter. We'll see them all out on the trail.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too. Enjoy your the holidays here.
Well, we hope you loved that interview as much as we did, and we want to say a special thank you for Zach and his family for letting us interview him. Hopefully you get a chance to go to the Sheep Mountain 150.
Yeah, or at least get to his website, take a look at what his lodge offers, www.sheepmountain.com. And by all means, if you're heading to Alaska, I definitely would go there. Sounds like an awesome place. It makes me like want to go right now.
Oh, absolutely. And especially because of the location, it just seems like you're just in the perfect spot to go to everything in Alaska. So it's a nice little move. I guess I say that. Alaska's a pretty big state. That's kind of crazy. But anyways, well, so thank you, Zach, so much. And now let's go on to Dr. Tim. And Dr. Tim's going to be talking about
vaccinations.
Here we go. Dr. Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about vaccinations?
Sure. There's a lot of controversy on vaccinations out there in the world today, and some rightly so, but when we deal with large kennels of dogs like what we have, we've got to look at it a little bit differently. First place I like to start is just to explain when we start vaccinations on puppies and what we try to do after that. So I usually begin vaccinations at the age of about 6 weeks. I go every 3 weeks until they're roughly about 4 months old, so 6, 9, 12, and about 15 weeks of age. There are differences between vaccinations, in my opinion, out there as to what are better vaccine companies than others or vaccine types than others. I tend to recommend either the Intervet or the Pfizer brand of vaccines right now, and that's apt to change if some other companies come out with some what I think are better vaccines. But 6, 9, 12, and 15 weeks is where I start vaccination schedules with pups. Again, mothers, we don't like to vaccinate mothers or pregnant dogs that are still carrying puppies. We do it before or after the puppies are born, preferably before. And then after that, we go on a yearly basis of vaccinations on our sled dogs. The things we vaccinate against are going to be the same things we vaccinate dogs at the vet for our house dogs, distemper and upper respiratory viruses, hepatitis, leptospirosis, and parvovirus. And to me, I think vaccinations are cheap insurance for dogs, especially sled dogs, in that for once a year, for a few dollars, if you're able to buy it without a vet administering it, we can guarantee or fairly much guarantee that we're going to have a protected kennel. When people talk about over-vaccination of dogs, and it's been shown that that is true, where these vaccines tend to last about 2 to 3 years in dogs, more times than not, the problem that I really see with that logic is they will last that long, but there also is a failure rate with vaccines, meaning that roughly 10% of the vaccines given or so are going to fail and not take adequately for a number of reasons. And when we deal with a kennel of 30 dogs, if we start to add up 10% and 10%, it can escalate pretty quick with leading to unprotected dogs. So my thought at this point is I've seen much more of a problem with no vaccines being on board with dogs than having too many vaccines on board with the dogs. So to me, with sled dog kennels, I tend to encourage yearly vaccines. I think it's, to me, very inexpensive insurance against some really horrendous diseases. If anyone's ever dealt with parvovirus or distemper in a kennel, it's really not fun. So to me, take the extra effort, do the shots. Don't worry about over-vaccinations, and that it really isn't going to harm them that much, if at all, from what I've seen. So the long and short of it with that is vaccinate your dogs on a yearly basis and keep track of what you're using. Use a good vaccine. Rabies vaccines are dependent upon what the state legislature or the provincial government recognizes as to how long they last. The vaccines are almost all the same with regards to rabies shots, but some states only recognize yearly vaccines, and some states will recognize up to 3 years following one vaccine. So it depends on where you live as to how long a rabies vaccine is recognized to be given and actually work in that state legislature's mind. So that's all government bureaucracy there. A lot of states will recognize only if a veterinarian is given the rabies shot if there's a bite issue with the dog. So if you have a dog that bites another person or another dog or whatever, they will only look at it as being a valid rabies shot if given by a licensed veterinarian. Alaska is a little different. Lay people can give it, but they have to go through a course. So you have to actually know if rabies shots are recognized in your state as to being given only by the vet or other people. So, again, it's state to state or province to province. So do your research there. And as to what vaccines to give, there's a lot of vaccines out there that you can give. And, again, there's preferences as to which ones to do. Like I said, the distemper, parvo, lepto portions are the most important. There's also coronavirus. There's Giardia vaccines. There's Lyme vaccines. I think that's really dependent upon where you live and what kind of exposure you get. I don't think they're nearly as necessary as the big ones like the distemper and the parvo shots these days. But the long and short of it, do it yearly. Use a good company that you trust in and keep your records straight so you know what you've done.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, along with that, does that also cover worming also?
Yeah, with deworming is separate. Our medicines are going to be, of course, different than the vaccine. So with your deworming schedule, which would be a whole other topic here, when we look at a deworming program with a kennel, I like to do it at least twice a year. I like to use several different products to use as a dewormer. And some of them aren't inexpensive, so you're going to have to bite the bullet with getting a good dewormer. The different dewormer types are something as simple as Strongia T, which is a liquid but only covers a couple of worms, to Panicure or the Drontel Plus stuff that covers most of the worms, if not all of the worms. So when I look at a kennel, I like to use at least one product a year that's going to cover everything, including tapeworms, such as the Drontel Plus or some of the other combinations of things like Interceptor and Cestex or something of that sort. But you want to try to get onto a deworming program that's going to cover hookworms, roundworms, whipworms, and tapeworms. And because we're out there racing a lot, we're going to come across a lot of other dogs that come from all over the place, and who knows what they might have. Dogs step in stool, they get exposed to it, and we bring it back to our kennel. So I think that if we stick to at least a twice-a-year deworming program, if not more, that's going to lead to the most success of what's going down in your kennel. I think regular fecal tests are always a good idea to make sure that your program's working. So even though we're not seeing loose stool on any regular basis, do a few dogs a year and just see what you might have. If you have some suspicions, check a few more dogs than that. Make sure your program is successful. But as a general rule, what I do is I tend to deworm towards the, towards the fall, and then again in the middle of racing season, and then after racing season is when I hit them with different dewormers. Again, what dewormer I choose, I try to choose something that's the broadest spectrum that I can afford, so covering the most bases, not just Strongia, which is the easiest and least expensive, but it just doesn't cover enough of the bases. So with that in mind, that's my general plan. Getting into puppies, I usually start to deworm puppies at about 2.5 weeks. I think it's key if you start then with Strongia T or the Nemex at 2.5 weeks, and then every 2 weeks after that, you're going to knock down the roundworms that puppies always get from their mom. And then I also will do the mother dog at the same time. So puppies get that starting at 2.5 weeks for every 2 weeks until they're off mom, and moms get it at the same time, and then they get added into the whole program of at least twice a year deworming with some product. And again, there's a number of different products out there, but something that covers the most bang for your buck. The other thing you have to concern yourself with is heartworm disease, and different parts of the country will be exposed to heartworm disease, and that's something that's mosquito-borne. The mosquito has to bite a dog with heartworm, then goes down the line and bites another dog without it, and that's how they catch it. So again, you need a dog that has heartworm to transmit it to the mosquito and then the mosquito to your dog. So if you live on the sticks and there's no other dogs around, there's no worry about heartworm to any large degree. If you live closer to other populations of animals, primarily dogs, of course, then you have to concern yourself with that. And heartworm preventative is easy to do. You just need to use ivermectin at a pretty reasonable dose, about a tenth of a cc per dog. And you cannot use that in a dog that's a collie breed or an Australian breed, if we have any border collie or collie breeds into our sled dogs or house dogs, then you have to use a different product called Interceptor that's safe to use with those types of dogs. It's always best to try to get dogs heartworm tested to make sure they're negative first and then put onto the ivermectin. It's hard to do when you have 50 dogs, so you might consider doing a few dogs a year to make sure you're keeping, again, a negative population the best of your ability, and then get them on a heartworm preventative starting typically a month after it becomes warm to a month after it becomes cold. And again, it depends on what part of the country you're in.
Well, Dr. Tim, I know like Interceptor has does heartworm, but does it do other things also?
Yeah, Interceptor is what we use in our kennel. It covers everything except tapeworms. So the Interceptor will do tapeworms or hookworms, roundworms, whipworms, and also the heartworm preventative. And then we'll occasionally use some sort of a product that covers tapeworms. Tapeworms are going to be something that we don't see very often. That's going to primarily come from different types of whitefish out there. Dogs that are eating chipmunks occasionally or voles in the ground, you'll get tapeworms from, but they're not a huge deal like some of the other big ones like whipworms and hookworms.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so that is interesting how to mix those. Do you recommend, obviously, sitting down with your vet and getting a plan together, or is it something you can do on your own, or what do you think?
Well, I think if you have a vet, you should kind of throw it by him or her and explain what you're trying to do and see what their thoughts are. A lot of these products, your vet will hopefully work with you on trying to make it affordable so we can get it into our big herd of dogs. If not, there's lots of places you can buy these products online as well. Some are prescription only, and some are not, so you just have to do your research. But vets are there to help you out. That's their job.
Oh, this has been fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tim.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim, for that interview on vaccinations. And if you want to learn more about Dr. Tim, don't forget, on Episode 3, we highlighted Dr. Tim, and he told us all about, all that he's doing.
Yeah, so you can just go to his website, www.drtims.com.
That's drtims.com.
Yeah.
I love that.
Oh, that's a good name.
Hope everybody has a wonderful week. Till next time.
Be blessed.